Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome to yet another segment of Afternoon Satsang. Today is a Holy Thursday and it is also the beginning of a new month, May of 2014, here. And well, with the beginning of this new month, there are some glad tidings for us also. Till now, Puttaparthi has been cooked and baked by the hot sun, with temperatures reaching almost 42 to 43 degrees Celsius. And the good news is that this month the temperatures will be coming down, possibly to something like 38 or 39 degrees. Just 4 degrees, not much, but indeed a great, great respite. Borrowing from the words of Neil Armstrong when he said, "A small step for man, but a giant leap for mankind." This is a small step for the thermometer, but a giant leap as far as the temperatures are concerned for us. And so, with a cool head and a cool body, of course, that is always cool at Radio Sai Global Harmony, because by Swami's immense love and grace, we have got such comfortable accommodation, such comfortable studios here. With gratitude to Swami, we begin and we continue this satsang where we left off last week. Just to refresh all your minds, last week we were speaking about the concept of moksha, and therefore we arrived at the three most important boons, or the three great blessings that one can get in one's journey towards moksha. This is according to the Viveka Chudamani of Sri Adi Shankaracharya. And those three blessings are: the first is manushyatvam, or a human birth. The second is mumukshatvam, or the desire for moksha. And the third is mahapurusha samshraya, or meeting with the perfected being. Last week we covered manushyatvam, which is a human birth. And this week we shall continue the satsang on mumukshatvam and mahapurusha samshraya. And always joining me, Arvind from Team Radio Sai, is Brother Prem from Team Radio Sai. Sairam Prem.
Sairam Arvind. And as you said, we spoke about manushyatvam last time, and it's the turn of mumukshatvam. Maybe I could start with a short story which one of the guests over here shared. You know, she was a Balvikas teacher, and in her dream she had the setting of a Balvikas class. And the interesting thing about this Balvikas class was Swami himself was there. And Swami was conducting the Balvikas class. And Swami looked at the class and he said, "What is the single most important thing to do anything? What is most needed if you want to accomplish a task?" And that was the question Swami asked. And very promptly, one of the little children there got up and he said, "Swami, self-confidence." Okay. And even before Swami could say whether it is the right answer or the wrong answer, the whole class burst into an applause, because they said, "Such a perfect answer. You know, it sounds so perfect." And Swami is asking, "What is most needed to do do any task?" And he says, "Self-confidence." So Swami waited till the applause settled. And then Swami said, "Self-confidence is very important, but you need something before that." And the whole class was in rapt attention. And Swami said, "Even before self-confidence, you need the will to do that thing." The reason why I'm drawing this particular anecdote and explaining is, see, the will to do, the will to achieve is so important, and even in a spiritual journey, that desire to attain that last final stage, the desire and the drive to reach there, that is such an essential thing, and that is what mumukshatvam actually stands for.
Beautiful. You know, as you said, the will or desire to achieve, that is what is followed by self-confidence, whether you can do it or not. Because self-confidence is more about, I can do it and I will do it. And it is based on different things, the most important being God. You know, that's where I feel that faith and self-confidence meet. Right. Because self-confidence is confidence in the self, which is God, which is nothing but faith. So, though self-confidence is amazing, what we need is, what is it that we wish to achieve through self-confidence? And that is what Swami, I'm sure, indicated in that dream to that Balvikas teacher. Speaking of Balvikas teachers, dear listeners, in our studios today, we have one little Balvikas student, and she is Navya from Pune, just 5.5 years of age, and she was very keen and eager to join us and listen to the satsang. And I definitely felt that this was a practical example of mumukshatvam, because she says, "I don't watch any TV, I don't see any movies, and my greatest joy is just listening to Swami's stories. And when I got to know that on this beautiful day, Swami's stories are going to be said here, this is what I would like to do. And so, even giving up her lunch, she's sitting here. So, I really felt that this is such a beautiful example of Mumukshatvam, where you have the desire to learn and know about the higher purpose in life, which we define as moksha.
Very true. You know, another thought which comes, Arvind, when you say Manishatvam, Mumukshatvam and Mahapurushatvam Shreya. You know, very often when Swami talks of the body, Swami uses the word instrument. Swami very clearly defines that you are not the body. Then if you are not the body, what is this body? Swami says it's a temple of God. Swami says, you know, so many different definitions Swami gives. But Swami also says that this body is an instrument which is given to you.
Correct.
See, in that sense, Manishatvam is also an instrument which is given to you. It is a means which has been granted to you. And that is why Swami says Manushatvam itself is a great blessing. It is not the end, but it is a means. So if you put it that way, so Manushatvam is the tool, Mumukshatvam is the will to achieve, and Mahapurusha Samshraya is that divine guidance to actually reach that ultimate goal.
Well put, Prem, because I think that an instrument can either be used or misused. A knife can be used to by a surgeon to heal, it can be used by a notorious person to kill.
Right.
So the tool by itself is not sufficient. The will to use the tool in the proper way, which is Mumukshatvam, is so very important, and that is where we are coming to. I mean, I feel Mumukshatvam in a way is an inbuilt thing, because you know, somehow or the other, if we see the general way things trend in life, a person may start off with the objective of earning money. He earns money, he earns more money, he goes on earning money, but at the end of it all, at one point, he reaches that level of saturation, I can say, because beyond that point, how much ever money you give him, there is no additional joy. There is no additional satisfaction or happiness, and the same thing that you thought will get you the greatest happiness doesn't seem to get you. The same holds good for somebody who pursues, say, a career or a relationship, or pursues power, or whatever. Once you achieve a certain level in that, beyond that, there doesn't seem to be any increasing satisfaction or joy in achieving that. And that is when a person starts to think, was it worth all this? I mean, I spent my whole life for money. I spent my whole life running behind this person or that person. Or I spent my whole life running behind power. Was it worth all this? I feel these are all the beginnings of Mumukshatvam, where you start thinking that is life all about just these things? As Swami would put it, khana, peena, sona, marna. Isn't there a higher purpose for life? I think that is the beginning of Mumukshatvam.
Very true. You know, Mumukshatvam need not necessarily begin with the desire for moksha. You know, the concept of moksha itself comes much later, I think. You know, even in our understanding, I think, as we spoke last time, there's so much of misunderstanding and misconception about what moksha or liberation is. So that crystallization itself is a process. So not that we start Mumukshatvam with the idea of what is moksha, but with this desire to unravel something which is not so obvious.
Exactly. So these are all, as you said, the starting steps, different ways. You know, that is how it begins. If we see the life of Gautam Buddha, that is how it began. You know, he had everything that a man possibly dreams for. You know, he had his wedding took place with one of the most beautiful women of the land, a princess, and he had the entire kingdom at his disposal, and all he saw in his life was only happy, happy, happy things. And yet, leading such a life too, it so happened that he felt that this is not enough. This didn't give him that ultimate satisfaction. Because if something gave ultimate satisfaction, why would dissatisfaction ever arise? So there is something in life that is beyond all that we see and we think as the most important. And just realizing that there is something in life beyond all this, that in itself is the starting point of this Mumukshatvam. As you rightly put, it's not as if somebody starts off by saying, I want moksha. Of course, there are some of us who, you know, like a parrot, we have learnt it, so we say, what do we want? We want moksha. We have no idea what moksha means. So moksha is not about a word and a meaning, it's about an entire process and it's a state of being. That is what we are trying to define through the satsang here. But it can get triggered off through all the things that we consider mundane and ephemeral and worldly.
Very true. Because, you know, Gautam Buddha was a perfect example. Because many people have that desire or that, you know, even more than desire, the kind of inquisitiveness to know what is more.
Hmm.
But not everybody has the guts which Gautam Buddha had. You know, the ability to kick the comfortable life you are in, to throw yourself out of that comfort zone and go in search of it. You know, that is a typical description of mumukshutva. That desperateness to find the, in the truth.
Yeah, that desperateness. You know, that is where, when you say that Gautam Buddha had the guts, that is where I think whether, you know, it is actually guts or is it that intense yearning and pining to know that is so strong that you don't mind doing it. Now, just imagine you on top of a 100-story building and you know for sure that when you look down from top, there is something that is amazing, something that is going to change your way of life itself. And you have fear of heights. Now, when you go and actually peep to look what it is it that you are being gutsy and brave, or is it that that intent to know what is there is so strong that you are ready to go to any extent without actually categorizing it as a brave thing? This is something that
absolutely
we cannot
right.
say. We will have to experience it ourselves and see.
In fact, you know, I was just seeing where else this word mumukshatvam actually comes with a strong meaning and where else it is being quoted.
Mm.
You know, there is a Vahini which Swami has written. It's called Sutra Vahini. I mean, these are Vahinis which we actually get, we don't get so acquainted with because they are very, very deep and profound in their, you know, narrative. They are not like Gita Vahini, which is
not light reading.
Right. I mean, Gita Vahini is a very philosophical text, but put in a conversation, it's easier.
Mm.
Ramkatha Ras Vahini and the Bhagavat Vahini, their stories so easily palatable and so enjoyable to read. But these are hardcore spiritual texts, the Upanishad Vahini or Sutra Vahini. You know, there is this aphorism, you know, sutra means an aphorism. A word which can, a sentence which contains in it a very, very deep and extended meaning.
Hmm.
The Brahma Sutras start with a very, very weird statement.
Hmm.
It says, Atatho Brahma Jignasa. Which
what
means,
does it mean? Hmm?
Henceforth, you will search for Brahman. Imagine
okay.
a body of work starts with this, henceforth you will search for Brahman.
Hmm.
So which means, what is there before that? And Swami in Sutra Vahini explains, first you have dharma jignasa, which means the desire to lead a rightful life, to desire to be good. And after you have led a rightful and good life, you go in search of the Brahman. Then brahma jignasa starts. And there it is said, you need four things. That's where this mumukshatvam comes in. It says vairagya, viveka, mumukshatvam and total self-control.
Hmm.
So that vairagya is such an important thing, and Swami says that vairagya comes spontaneously when you feel that there is nothing which I want in what I am seeking. In this worldly life, I will not find it. And as you said, it is not just guts, it is not just bravery, it is that complete understanding that I will not find it here. I need to seek elsewhere.
But when you say this, you know, there is, as you said, it is so profound and deep. Usually, when something that is profound and deep is spoken or said, what people do is what they do to an idol of Lord Ganesha. Yes, we will keep it in the altar and worship it, but that's about it. You know, people say that, you know, I'm not looking at all this. You know, I don't want to attain moksha or do all this. No, I don't want it. I just want to lead a happy and peaceful life. That's all I want. So you don't give me all these, don't give me aphorisms from Sutra Vahini. It just makes me not understand anything. It just confuses me. So, this is generally what our reaction would be.
Right.
That I just want to be happy and peaceful. And I feel this itself is beautiful because that is the starting point. That is where even Gautam Buddha started off. You know, I don't want suffering, I don't want pain.
Very
that
true.
Is something that all of us associate with. So we start off with that and then as we progress, the journey itself unfolds. And dear listeners, we feel that this is one very important aspect about moksha or seeking moksha, that it cannot be explained. It is something that has to be experienced. How much ever we may prattle on over here, it will just fill airtime and fill some good words and good sounds, but ultimately it's an experience that one has to embark upon, and one should feel the need to embark upon. You know, one small clarification here. For example, you know, I'm reminded of an incident where, you know, our Professor G. Venkatraman, who is heading the Radio Sai Studios, he was asked a question. The question was, will an atheist is a person who doesn't believe in God.
Right.
Will he be able to achieve moksha? Or will he be able to achieve the ultimate divinity? Is it possible? How can he achieve moksha, which we so closely link with God, when he doesn't believe in the concept of God itself? So, Professor G.V., I remember the answer that he gave. He took a kind of a middle path. He said, see, when a person, if he is good, the goodness that he embodies will ensure that in the next birth, he will get a birth as a devotee of the Lord, and therefore ensure that he is able to get moksha. So though he did not state explicitly, it was implicit that if you are not a devotee of the Lord, you can't expect to get moksha. Because if you are not a devotee of the Lord but a good person, the best you can expect is to get a birth as a devotee of the Lord,
right,
through via which you can achieve moksha. So this is what Professor G.V. answered. Now, when this was being broadcast on Radio Sai, you know, Swami had so graciously got speakers and this Radio Sai installed in his own room at Yajur Mandir. So, the brother who was there with Swami that time, he says that this was going on and they heard G.V. sir's answer, both Swami and his brother, and he could not contain. So he thought, why not ask Swami directly? He is the sanctioning authority. So he asked Swami, Swami, what about people who don't believe in God? Can they get moksha? What the professor said, was it right or wrong? So then Swami looked at him and he said, anybody can get moksha. It is not as if only the atheist can get it. Anybody can get it. All one has to do is give up dehabhimanam. Dehabhimanam meaning body consciousness or attachment to the body, or thinking that
feeling
this whole...
Feeling that I am the body.
Feeling that you are the body and feeling that everything associated with the body and the mind are true and real. That is what makes us pursue wealth, career, power, relationships, right? Because we feel that this body and mind is us. So Swami says, anybody who can overcome that gets moksha. So you need not be a devotee. Now, why I told this whole incident is it brings back to the question where, you know, if it does not matter whether I am an atheist or a theist, why should I believe in God? Why should I follow Swami? If putting it little more, you know, extrapolating a little bit more, if it doesn't matter how I am, who I am, I mean, if it doesn't matter how I am because what matters is who I am alone, then why should I be good? What is the need to be good? Because Swami is saying there's no difference. All that you need to do is give up body consciousness. And then you achieve the ultimate. Then, that is why they say, you know, God's love is equal for all. Because for God there's nothing like good, bad. The question that comes with all these long introduction, the question that I want to ask is, then why does Swami encourage us to do good? Why does Swami discourage us from doing bad? Why does Swami says, no, don't do this? Why does he correct us? Why does he scold us? Why does he tell us to stick to the path of dharma, to the path of nobility, to the path of good, when both good and bad are equal? That is a question that often arises in the minds of people. You know, this is all linked to mumukshatvam, because when we tell moksha, we don't associate moksha with violence, killing, hatred, jealousy, anger. We associate moksha with peace, love, honesty, truthfulness, all the good things. If moksha is independent of good and bad, why do we stress on the good then? Because all that you may tell philosophically, again, it doesn't matter to me, all I want is peace of mind and happiness. And so, when I can choose the easier way, you know, often the noble path often turns out to be the tougher path. There are so many easier ways. I mean, even, for example, if you were to go to... I'm going into many detours here, Prem, and if you see me becoming incoherent, please connect me back.
Sure.
So, for example, I mean to say, when I go to take a driving license, for example, And you see there that the person there is corrupt and he wants a bribe. After all, it's just, say, $100. And your license actually costs about $300 or something. So it's just about 20% more you have to pay. And you are saved of all the hassles of everything. It seems so easy to give the 100 and be done with it. Get your license and be back. It is an easier path. Why should I then stick and undergo torture? He will then insult me. He will then tell, go and join the line. He will purposely increase impediments in my way. Give me so much trouble. Is it worth bearing all the trouble to be good? Why should I be good? Why not take the easier path and be done? If it's going to give me comfort, peace and happiness, I get my license, right? So that is the question that comes when one is told to have mumukshatvam or pursue the path of God or pursue the path of nobility. Because, you know, this path of God and path of nobility is filled with so much of restrictions. I have to do this, I have to do this. Everybody will do whatever and get away with it. I am supposed to keep doing this. So that is why I say it is linked to the question on why should I be good? Why can't I just be bad and enjoy? Am I clear in my thinking? I mean, is it fine?
Yeah, I think what you're saying is right. One discourse I was going through, where Swami is saying, you know, the three layers. I mean, we've heard these three words many times. Swami says conscious, conscience and consciousness.
Mm.
In essence, conscious is just being awake, just being aware of what is going around you. Just in your normal sense.
Even a cow is, even yes. A buffalo is.
Conscience, Swami says, is the inner voice, the voice of God. And consciousness is that absolute state. You know, the beauty is, you would see many people, you know, when they go to God, it is more with a feeling of dirt, more with a feeling of I am wrong. That itself shows that you cannot actually go to that state of higher desire for that higher state if you feel that you are not good.
Hmm.
You know, those people who are not doing the right thing, they don't feel that desire to reach the ultimate state because they feel that, you know, I'm not good anyway. So it's almost like that filtering state, that conscience. As long as that conscience is not clear, I don't think you can look for a spiritual, you know, progress in life at all.
That's a very terrific point you have made, Prem, because I feel therein lies the crux as to why be good when being bad apparently gives you benefits easily. You see, the one difference between good and bad, okay, I mean, I may be wrong in my classification of people whom I think are good and people whom I think are bad. Mm-hmm. But if each one of us imagine somebody whom we think is good and somebody whom we think is bad, you see, the bad never tries to fight the good. You will never see where, in the sense, what I'm saying is, if a robber wants to rob, if a thief wants to steal something, he wants people who are innocent and gullible. The good people. He wants the innocent people. He knows that if there's another robber there, means anybody who is as bad as him, he can't do what he wants to do because he will be outwitted and it will be a battle. So it's almost like the bad needs the good for its survival. And the bad makes no attempt to change the good people into becoming bad. It makes no attempt, it's happy. You good people, you be there. Good people who trust me, good people who are innocent, you all be there. Because you are there only, I am able to thrive. So it's good. But the problem is, the good always tries to transform the bad. You see, it means even sometimes, you know, though we never speak it aloud on the mic or tell others, in our heart somewhere we feel that, you know what, we are doing a good job. We are working for Swami. We are working in Radio Sai. We are spreading Swami's message and, you know, bringing about a change. And this change that we talk about is actually the change of bad to good. So somewhere good exists because good apparently doesn't seem to have any other benefit other than the benefit that we are bringing about a positive change. So good is always intent on changing the bad. Good wants to change the bad. While bad has no interest in changing the good. Bad is happy with status quo. And this is where the problem comes because the dual world is meant to have good and bad, light and darkness, happiness and sorrow, black and white. The dual world will always be like this. There is nothing you can do to change it. Because how much ever you shine light, bang opposite somewhere at the other pole, there will be darkness. You just cannot. You cannot wipe out darkness completely till you wipe out light completely. Because light is the cause for darkness somewhere else. So in the same way, this good and bad are meant to be there. Good is the cause for the bad, bad is the cause for the good. Now what happens is, when you're bad, you're happy with status quo in the dual world. But when you're good, you want to change. And so you start making efforts to change the bad. You put in more and more efforts, more and more efforts, more and more efforts. You keep putting so many efforts, but you know what? You're never going to change the bad, because that's the nature of the world. The good and bad have to remain. Finally, you get frustrated. And that breaking point actually is also a making point, because that is when you turn inward. That is what happened to Gautam Buddha. He started off to find a cure for sickness, old age and death. But he ended up with enlightenment, in which he didn't change the external world, but he changed the world within. He changed his internal world, and he moved from a dual world to an Advaitic world. A world of oneness. And that is why later on he said that there is nothing like a god, there is nothing like worshipping, it's all nothing, it's just a state of, today it's called as a state of being the Buddha. The enlightened one, they call it, the Bodhisattva. Being in the state of the Bodhisattva. So, what happens, the advantage that the good has, is because good is constantly trying to change the bad, which the bad is not trying, good will meet failure after failure, failure after failure, failure after failure, and these failures turn out to be the stepping stones in discovering the reality that this dual world is false. And you turn inward. And that, you know, that contributes to mumukshatvam, that intensity and the desire to know the reality and not the way we perceive the jagat or the world.
Very true. I think, you know, just rephrasing it a little bit, the way I see it, I see when you're a good person, you know, when, let's say you're a bad person, and to your knowledge, you have done a lot of mistakes. You've done a lot of mistakes, and then you have been served a raw deal in life. You can always look back and say, see, I did this thing bad to this person. Maybe it's getting back to me.
Correct.
You know, I've done all these mistakes, and I'm reaping the curse of the mistakes I've done. But the good person, when he's been good all his life, and when difficulty comes and strikes him, and disaster comes and strikes him, the first question is, when I've been all good all through my life, why is this happening? You know, that question of why me or why is this happening is the starting point. You start asking, why is this happening? I have to find out the reason. There are two things which can happen there. One, I think many people get into that.
Disillusionment.
And the victimhood, you know, self-sympathy and victimhood. He said, see, I'm good to everybody. It happens only with me. God is being cruel to me. That is why you have been given a concept called karma. Where, you know, whether it's true or is it as illusionary as your life itself, it's a different point of talking. But you've been given a model which says that take responsibility for what is happening in your life. That is, when you take responsibility, you don't feel sorry for yourself, but that question will always be there. Why is this happening? What would I have done? You know, what should I do to get away from what I have done? What should I do to stop myself from getting into this cycle again and again? I think that is what comes out of goodness, and that mumukshatvam is nothing but that. That desire to go beyond this normal physical plane.
Exactly. Because then alone, you will achieve what you actually seek. Happiness, happiness, happiness. Till you are able to search for it within, it will not come. And as you rightly put it, it is this mumukshatvam that also makes us immune to these things. Because later on when we see, Buddha became immune to all this. And though he did not cure old age, he did not cure suffering, he did not cure death, he was beyond all these things. That is what happens. That is what happens. And once you realize that there is something beyond what we see, and you decide that this is what I should seek, and how is it that I seek, that is the beginning of mumukshatvam. And that doesn't come easily and naturally. If we take the karma theory point of view, you have to undergo many births where you go through all this, so that you are born directly saying that, you know, I don't want to seek anything else. I want to seek only Swami. Just like, for example, when we asked little Navya here, what do you want? She said she wants only Swami. Correct?
It goes first and afterwards rock. And first rock, afterwards rose. Like that. Rock will come, and we will go slowly to Swami. If we do good, afterwards it will be bad for us.
Oh.
Okay,
what was it? If you choose a good path, once again, what do you say? If you choose a good path
of rose petals, then if you choose good path, we walk to rocks, then only we can go to roses, then only we can reach them. When we choose bad path, we go about rose, afterwards we go about rocks.
Wow. Well, you know, that is wisdom. And Navya says that when you choose the good path, in the beginning there appear to be rocks, but later on the path it's roses. But if you choose the easier path, because there are roses in the beginning, rose petals strewn on the path, and you choose the bad path because it looks like the easier path, later on you will come across rocks and you will collapse before you meet your destination. I think that those are beautiful words of wisdom which come from the innocence and wisdom of a child. Thank you, Navya, for those words. Dear listeners, we are excited to continue along this discussion of Mumukshatvam and Mahapurusha Samshraya, which we shall come to shortly. Before that, we just take this little break. We'll be back after the song.
प्यार का सागर है तू प्यार का सागर है तेरी एक बूंद के प्यासे हम तेरी एक बूंद के प्यासे हम तू प्यार का सागर है तू प्यार का सागर है तेरी एक बूंद के प्यासे हम तेरी एक बूंद के प्यासे हम तू प्यार का सागर
जिस पर तुमने साई जन्म लिया तुमने जन्म लिया दीन दुखी को गले लगाया युग उपकार किया युग उपकार किया चांद और सितारे जयकार करेंगे सदा तेरी जयकार करेंगे सदा तू प्यार का सागर है तुम ही प्राण सखा तुम ही प्राण सखा सब है पराए तुम ही तो अपने तुमने प्यार दिया तुमने प्यार दिया कहते रहेंगे सदा कहते रहेंगे सदा कि तुमसे हो न कभी भी जुदा कि तुमसे हो न कभी भी जुदा तू प्यार का सागर है तू सागर है तेरी एक बूंद के प्यासे हम तेरी एक बूंद के प्यासे हम तू प्यार का सागर है तू प्यार का सागर है
Welcome back, dear listeners. After that song, we'll continue this discussion on Mumukshatvam. You know, Arvind, one of our teachers, we've spoken about him many times, Anil Kumar sir, he's been our chemistry teacher. He was telling...
For our listeners' clarity, this is different from the Professor Anil Kumar Professor who translates right. Swami's discourse. Yeah, okay.
You know, he was telling when Swami had called him for an interview. And Swami was talking to him. And suddenly Swami asked him, hey, do you want to lead a spiritual life? Okay. Imagine Swami asking you this question. Do you want to lead a spiritual life? And he said, no, Swami, I'm not interested in a spiritual life. He said, Swami, I'm living here. I know you. I'm living for you. Whatever I do out of love for you. And you love me. I know that you love me. What more than this do I want? Why would I need a spiritual life, you know, when life is so beautiful? Swami looked at him and very beautifully Swami said, can there be a life more spiritual than this? You know, we all have, I think, our weird idea of what is it to be a spiritual sadhaka, what is it to lead a spiritual life. But in fact, what Swami does to us, just by being with us, just by, you know, by igniting that love in our hearts and making us do things inspired by that love, there can be nothing more spiritual than that. You know, I'm reminded of what one of our brothers who is working in the ashram, he was sharing. You know, when he was in his 12th standard, he went up to Swami and generally we ask Swami what studies we should take further. Swami looked at this boy and said, you know, you stop after 12th standard. You just take up some job in the ashram, you stop. And this boy was quite surprised because Swami is always very particular that you finish your education and then you serve Swami. He said, Swami, but I've just finished my 12th. Swami said, no, it's enough. You stop with your 12th and you start, you know, take up a job. So this boy said, Swami, anyway, I want to serve you. I want to be here. Can I just complete some graduation? I'll just do a BA or a BSc or something and then I'll start serving you. Swami said, what do you want to do in life? He said, Swami, I want to stay back here and serve you. Then what does it matter whether you're going to serve me after 12th standard or after BSc? Swami said, stop your studies and start serving me. So this boy said, Swami, then people will not respect me in this world. You know, I will be seen as a school dropout. You know, I don't even have a degree to show myself as, you know, somebody of standing in the society. Then Swami looked at him and he said, if I say something, will you follow or not? He said, yes, Swami. And Swami told him, this is good for you. Stop with your 12th and start serving me. And what this boy asked after that was very, very beautiful, you know. He said, Swami, if you want me to do that, I want a boon from you. He said. And Swami said, boon? Okay, what boon do you want? So this boy said, Swami, the next time, don't give me a choice. Choose what is right for me and make me do it no matter what my choice is. He said, you should just make me do what you want me to do. You know, Swami was so pleased with that prayer of his. It seems Swami called him and hugged him. Swami said, I'm so happy. If you look at it, I said, you know, there were the four steps to leading towards Brahma Jignasa. I said, Vivek, you know, Vairagya, Viveka. Can there be a better Vairagya than this? And this Vairagya is inspired spontaneously by the love that boy had for Swami. You know, you're so attached to the name which people will give you in the society. You're so attached to what people will think of you. But when that is being put in a balance with what Swami wants you to do, without any hesitation, you just let it go. Can there be a better form of Vairagya than that? I think that is what Swami taught us through, you know, in our life, in our association with him.
He brought us here, as he himself so nicely puts it, he says, I give you what you seek, so that one day you seek what I have come to give. And that has been the story of all our lives. You know, that is one more reason why, interestingly, of late, you know, last few years, ever since I have joined in Radio Sai, we have spent so much time in reading about Swami's story, reading his message, his teachings, and, you know, trying to see the practical relevance of all of them. And I've got so inspired and enthused about them.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow, you know, in my heart, I always, whenever I'm told to give a talk anywhere, either in the hall here or anywhere else, invariably 50 to 60% or 70% of my talk will be experiences with Swami and things that Swami did. So there were occasions when I used to get this question, whether, do you want to spend all your time telling stories? Do you want to be a storyteller? Don't you want to spread Swami's message that you have assimilated and that you are so inspired about? And whenever this question comes, I used to think that, you know, maybe I'm just playing to the crowd, you know, dancing to their tunes. They like to listen to Swami's stories, so I'm telling them Swami's stories, that's all. But I'm not actually, you know, I'm not a good missionary. I'm not actually doing Swami's work in spreading his teachings, because innumerable times Swami has said that, you know, my name is not important. In the sense, it's not important that they worship Sathya Sai. They should revere and follow the teachings, because that is the truth. They should follow the truth. That's all it is. That was when, you know, I got this insight. I just felt that, see, what is the reason that now I'm at least attempting to follow Swami's teachings or read, or I cannot claim that I'm following, but why do I attempt to follow it? It's because I love Swami so much. That I have no doubts about, you know. I'm not saying that I think, I'm convinced. I love Swami so much. And that is why I try to follow, or in my own way, I try to live up to his teachings and words. So it is not as if I was inspired by his teachings and now I started loving him. I just loved him and he made me fall in love with him, and because of that I am ready to follow his teachings. And I feel that is where the key lies. So that is what I thought, even when it comes to my talks, it is not as if me reparating or telling out his teachings will inspire people. My objective when I speak is, if at all by this I can plant a small seed of love for Swami in your heart, that is enough for me, because that love for Swami itself will drive you towards the ultimate goal in life. Just like how, if at all I can say that I am having a desire to know the higher purpose in life, it's only because I love Swami so much and that is why I want to seek Him more and find out more about Him. So in the same way, I think this is what Swami does, as you said, to all of us. When He calls us here, He calls us on different pretexts. One of us come here because our parents are sick and suffering and we want some healing. Some of us come here maybe because the education is free and it's good quality education. Why not make use of it? Or some others may come here because it is safe, whatever, financially it is better. So many reasons. The different reasons everyone comes here for. But having grown in the system and been with Swami, automatically all the different things, they get polarized towards only one goal, that is making Swami happy. And once your objective becomes making Swami happy, that is when He starts giving us what He has actually come to give. In the beginning it is, I want to become happy by coming here. That is the time when He gives us whatever we seek. And then, having been so thrilled, we want to make Swami happy, that is when He starts demanding of us different sadhanas, different disciplines, so that He can give us what He has actually come to give, which is the ultimate. And so, for us, it has been such a blessing that this mumukshatvam also has got built into a process where we are fast forwarded through all these desires of the world to firmly and fast, quickly come upon zeroing in onto Swami and making Swami happy.
As I always tell people, and I tell myself also, you know, generally you become a seeker and then you find God. We all were forced to become seekers because we found God. You know,
yes.
For us, that Mahapurusha Samshraya was given to us. Maybe we were seekers before, but we have no knowledge of that to comment on it. But the idea that we have come to Swami has led us to believe that, you know, there is something more to the Swami which we might miss out. And that desperateness not to miss out Swami is what is leading us to become mumukshus, if you could put it that way. Because, you know, we were talking to Brother Sanjay Malingam once about trips to Kodaikanal.
Hmm.
And then he said a very beautiful point. He said, you know, there are two things which are in abundance in Kodaikanal when you go with Swami, when Swami takes you, you know, along with a group of students. One is food.
Oh, yes. Five times a day.
Okay, five times a day, and each meal is as
sumptuous.
Good, you know, very, as another student was pointing out, Swami was telling you know, in the discourse between the meals that you're not the body and you have to control your food and control your tongue. But when you go in for lunch, there are 12 items on the plate.
20 items, 25,
20 items sometimes. You know, that is when he said, at the end of those 10 days, you will reach vairagya towards food.
You'll be really fed up.
You'll be really, exactly. You know, you'll be fed up to the last inch in your body. And he said, there are times when food will be brought in front of you after that trip to Kodaikanal and you'll run away.
Hmm.
And he said, see, the vairagya towards food is a very, very important, you know, a quality which has to come in any sadhaka.
We had actually discussed this kind of vairagya also. This is a vairagya that comes from an excess.
Right, vairagya which comes from an excess.
Yes, when you have excess of it, you feel like enough, I don't want
it. So that is one thing. And the other thing which is given in immense measure,
abundance
is the presence of Swami.
Of course.
Because in that
you are dining
hours,
with him,
right?
You are sitting with him, all his sessions outside his bedroom are with you.
Right.
Except for the few hours when he retires into his bedroom, all others from the morning till night, yes.
And you get go out for picnics with him.
And in fact, one Kodai trip, you may get that much physical interaction with Swami or in being in the physical presence of Swami, which you cannot get by attending regular daily darshans for almost a year.
Absolutely. And you know, and then he made a very, very, honest definition of what he went through.
Mm.
He said, at a point, you will start getting bored of Swami's presence.
Mm, that takes
courage
to
getting,
say that.
Because you're getting so much of it.
Mm.
And that's when you will start questioning yourself, if I'm getting bored of this presence, which means I'm only treating Swami as this body. You'll get bored of only when you sit with a person.
Mm.
If you really believe that Swami is divine, if you really believe that Swami is that embodiment of pure love, how can you ever be bored of Swami?
Mm.
Which means that somewhere there is an impurity in the way you approach Swami.
Mm.
He said, somewhere you are not receiving Swami completely. Somewhere you are seeing Swami only as that physical body, because so much of time has gone in, you know, the desire to be close to Swami, the desire to achieve that proximity, that when you get close, you feel that there is something more. There's something more to Swami, and that's when you really become a sadhaka.
Beautifully put, Prem, because, you know, I often use this example and I find it very, very invigorating because it was when it occurred to me. You know, when we are asked, what is it that you want? We all say, no, if you put the question, if Swami were to come before you and ask, what is it that you want? What will you ask? All the intelligent ones, like you and me, all of us, we will say that, Swami, we want you, nothing else, we want Swami. Now that is what we think is the highest. But I feel that we often ask for something which we theoretically know, which we actually don't understand. For example, if I say I want Swami, what does it mean? Suppose Swami tells me, okay, come, you want me? Come, sit. And Swami is on the chair, he makes me sit by his side. Am I happy? Yes, I am on top of the world. This is what I wanted. I start pressing Swami's feet. I am so blissful. This is what you want? Yes, Swami, this is all that I want. So now you are pressing his feet and you are sitting there. Say 1 hour passes, 2 hour passes. Now, I have seen it happen to me, you know, once when I was doing Pad Seva, within half an hour, because Swami says, press hard, you know. Swami, though his leg appears so delicate, he is able to withstand great pressure. And that pressure that you put, it starts aching your forearms. And Swami looks and says, that's all, put more, your forearms are aching. So after 2 hours, when your forearms are aching, now are you happy? No, I am really telling, it's very tough to be happy, Prem, because your forearms are aching so much. No, let's take it a little more further.
It's really a battle, because in one side you're saying that this is a chance which you really, you know,
this is the ultimate,
for.
This is what I want.
But at the same time, the fatigue in the body is actually wanting you to...
Yes, he says that this is not what I want. Let's take a little more further. Say, after 4 hours now. Now your stomach starts grumbling. You're feeling thirsty. Do you want water or food or do you want Swami? You said the only thing that you want is Swami, right? So, now what happened? Why are you saying you want to go and have food? He'll be like, yeah, now let me have food, after that I'll come back to you. Stretch it even more further, say it goes on for 8 hours. Now you get that call which nobody can refuse, the call that nature gives. When you get that call, now what do? You want to go there or do you want to sit here with Swami? You said Swami is all that you want. So then, were you lying when you said that you want Swami and nothing else? We were not lying, but we do not understand what is it that we mean when we say we want Swami. And as you pointed out, a trip to Kodaikanal makes this very clear. You say you want Swami day in and day out, you have got Swami. But are you happy? Are you contented? Are you peaceful? Are you feeling on top of the world where nothing can ever touch your peace and happiness? No. That is when you start thinking deeper. And as you rightly said, that is when you cease being a person who is near to Swami and you start contemplating on how you can become dear to Swami, and then you become a sadhaka and you go on to the path, the path of sadhana. It is so beautiful because, you know, in the Viveka Chudamani, Mahapurusha Samshraya or a meeting or being with the perfected being is considered as a third blessing. We have been so blessed. You know, it is said, in that Viveka Chudamani, it is said that you may get a human birth. You may get the desire to know the ultimate reality. But then you will just be floundering in life. You will not get that support and, you know, you will not get that guidance. How many saints have spent their whole lives in pursuit of this? So therefore it is said that the third greatest blessing that you can get is a guru or a perfected being who can guide you along, saying that, good, you have realized the purpose of human birth and you are seeking it. Now I will guide you on how to do that instruction manual. That instruction manual which is personalized according to each person's attitude and each person's tendencies. That is very, very, very important, that only a Mahapurusha can give. And we have been so blessed that whether or not we have got Mumukshatvam, it is often said that when you have got one and two, if you are lucky, you will get three also, which will give you the push. We have all been blessed that we got one and we got us three. And Mahapurusha came and put in the seeds of Mumukshatvam in us. Really, how grateful we should be to Swami that He has brought us in close proximity to Him, to His touch. I'm not meaning, when I say Swami's touch, I'm not meaning a physical touch. Because again, you know, I'm reminded of this little child sitting right in front of me over here. She has physically not seen Swami. So, when you say Swami's touch, it does not mean only those who lived in that era between 1950 to 2011 who physically saw Swami. That is of course one kind of touch. But the Master's touch extends beyond into many realms. So, that is Mahapurusha Samshraya. Can you say that Mirabai did not have the touch of Krishna? Can you say that Tyagaraja did not have the touch of Rama? So that proximity to Rama, that proximity to Krishna that these people enjoyed, that is the proximity to Sai that we enjoy because we know Sai and we seek Sai. And when we get that Mahapurusha Samshraya, Mumukshatvam, even though we don't have it, automatically gets cultivated. And that is why Swami sometimes says, Adugakuve O Manasa, O mind, don't ask. Just shut up. Just sit. Don't worry, all that you need will be taken care of once you have taken refuge at the feet of Partisha. And for that, I feel so grateful to Swami.
You know, we spoke about getting Mumukshatvam because of getting Mahapurusha Samshraya. But even those who have been blessed with that Mumukshatvam, even those who have been given that drive to achieve that ultimate state, most definitely need a Mahapurusha Samshraya. As you said, you know, it's very, very important. In fact, in one place, Swami says that when you become a, let's say you become a jnani, you start doing tapas and you want to reach that ultimate state. Swami says there's one penultimate state, which Swami refers to as rasa swadhana. Mm-hmm. He says you will be in a state of bliss all the time. But Swami says that is not the ultimate state. But a sadhaka who reaches that state will think that is the ultimate state. And Swami says there are people who spend births in that state without knowing that you can actually go beyond that. And Swami says that is why a guru is so essential. That you might get stuck up anywhere in the path thinking that is the ultimate. The guru who is beyond all this can tell you that no, you're not yet there. You need to do this.
At the risk of appearing boastful, let me just narrate one analogy which I feel so perfectly matches here. You know, in Puttaparthi, as we go beyond Karnataka Nagapalli, the village, there are two huge hills, one which we have nicknamed as Shiva and Parvati. The higher one is called Shiva, the lower one Parvati. From far it looks like just one straight hill. But when you go close, you know, it has so many ups and downs, and so many false peaks, if I may call so. The first time when I was climbing, you know, as I went climbing, I felt that I have reached the summit. and I was celebrating, I was happy. It took almost 1.5 hours of trekking. And as I went ahead, suddenly I saw that little more one path is going up. And then I saw that what appeared as the summit from below, from right at the foothills. From far you can see the summit, of course.
Okay.
But at the foot of the hill, what appears to be the summit is not actually the summit. It's a pseudo summit.
Mm-hmm.
And then I discovered that there are two such pseudo summits, which because of chance, I discovered that it is not a summit and I can climb higher. And finally, when you reach the summit, you see that there is nothing beyond. I find this analogy so perfect because when you reach the ultimate state, even on searching, you will not find anything beyond. The next time, you know, that hill I have climbed at least 7 times till now. And the next 6 times were with different groups. Without fail, every group fell for this pseudo summit, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They felt that, this is the top. That's it. We are here, Abba. We have reached finally 1 hour. We have climbed. Good. We have done good pace. And I tell them, no, this is not the top. They say, what do you mean this is not the top? Then I take them to the path and show it. And then they said, oh my God, it is still there. And as I said, at the cost of appearing boastful, I feel this analogy fits, that's all, in that aspect that the Guru is a person who has actually descended for our ascent. It's literally like that. He has descended for our ascent, so he knows where the top is. And therefore, he is able to, even though we are making efforts and reaching, so that we don't get stuck at the pseudo top, he is able to enthuse us and tell us and guide us and advise us and take us to the actual top. After which, you know, having reached that state, after that, we can also ourselves take others to the top. Having reached that state, we become one with the Guru. We become same as the Guru, which is mumukshatvam, and I mean, which is moksha. And therefore, as you said, Mahapurusha Samshraya is very, very, very important, very vital, even for a person who has done a lot of efforts and who is focused on the path.
And that is what happened, you know, we spoke of Swami's childhood, we spoke of so many incidents in Swami's life, in Swami's students' lives. You know, even that Naga Sadhu was brought to Swami to challenge Swami, you know, when Swami was a teenager. Swami even told him that you're being misguided. You know, you are a sadhaka, but you're being misguided. You know, the life that you're supposed to lead in the forest, you're trying to lead in the middle of the society. You know, that is what Swami did for every one of us in our own way. You know, we were not all like that Naga Sadhu who needed that kind of strong reprimand. But in our own small ways, we were doing mistakes and Swami was coming and pointing us out. You know, I was reminded of one of our seniors once shared with us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this boy had come to become Swami's student. And for some reason, he didn't clear that entrance. The entrance was in Vrindavan. This was in old Vrindavan. So he came, Swami was in Puttaparthi. He decided that till Swami gives him a seat, he is not going to go back to his town, which was Assam. Okay, and those were the days when Swami used to do that. When Swami used to have his own candidates for the, you know, university. Swami would call them and Swami would call the principal and say that take these boys. Mm-hmm. They come from so far. So this boy wanted to please Swami so that Swami will give him that seat, even though the classes had already started. So this boy was waiting. Swami would not look at him. Swami would not speak to him. He lost his money which he had kept. So the resources were limited. So he decided that he's going to stop eating. He said, if I stop eating my food, then Swami will take sympathy on me and he'll have to come and confer the blessing I'm seeking. So he started eating. He was saying that he would eat nothing but just a handful of buttermilk rice once a day. And he went on like this for not 1 or 2 days, not few weeks, but for 6 months.
Oh.
And at the end of it, he was like just a bag of bones. And finally, after nearly 6 months, when Swami comes and calls him for an interview, Swami was walking for darshan, Swami called him for an interview, he got up and collapsed. That's how weak he was. Okay. And finally, Swami calls him for that interview. He enters the interview room, Swami is inside the interview room. The moment he enters, Swami tells him, I did not call you because you starved. Let me make it very clear, I do not approve of this. I did not call you because you starved. I called you only because I have grace on you. I have compassion for you. You know, this is a misconception which all of us have.
Correct.
You know, Swami says you cannot kill the snake by beating the anthill. Swami would say that you cannot reach the soul by putting the body to suffering. You know, these are the things with Swami which you will get only if you have a Mahapurusha Samshraya. The authority of a perfected being.
You know, this thing about the benefits of Mahapurusha Samshraya, of course the Buddha too realized it. That's what he has brought out as the middle path. He says that don't go to the extreme. But you know what all the Buddha went through? I mean, if you want to do it without an enlightened being to guide you, you know how tough and how nearly impossible it is going to be. That is why they don't say that, you know, the Viveka Chudramani doesn't say that you will not attain at all. But it says if you get these three, these are like blessings. These are like those
special grace.
Speed boosters in your journey, which will help you to achieve it faster and more easy, in an easier manner, because it is coming. Yes, of course, the Buddha achieved it. But what, you read his story, read what all he went through, the rigors. When he fasted, he was not even a bag of bones. I mean, the way it happened to him, and finally he realized that this is not the way. So, if you can think that the lesson that the Buddha got after years of such travails and tribulations, if you could get it, even though 6 months appear huge, 6 months is nothing compared to years. So that is, as you rightly said, the boon that Mahapurusha Samshraya gives. And, you know, let us not underestimate, let us not think that, you know, my great-grandfather was a devotee of Swami, therefore my family has been devotees and now I am born in this family, I have not seen Swami, so I am just a devotee of Swami, what's so great in it? It's not so easy. And every time I think about how rare it is, how fantastic it is to be accepted by a Mahapurusha, to be taken under the wings of a Mahapurusha, you know, I realize this through an incident that was narrated in our studios by a Samiti convener from Madhya Pradesh.
Mm-hmm.
And I can never forget that. And I think it is interesting and it will be good to retain this incident after this little break. Dear listeners, don't go anywhere. This is a fantastic incident which shows, which clears all our misconceptions when we think that, you know, it was by luck that we came to Swami, we just got to know Swami, it was a coincidence, it was this. Nobody can even get to know of Swami. You won't even know of Swami unless he wills and he has decided. And we shall narrate that incident after this little break.
விடநாடகு என்னடு பந்தமோ சுவாமி அந்தரயாமி విద్యాలయమా కానీ కాదు
ఉండే ప్రేమాలయం ప్రపంచాన ప్రకాశించు జ్ఞాన దీపాల వలే ప్రపంచాన ప్రకాశించు జ్ఞాన దీపాల వలే బహుమలచిన స్వామి నిన్ను మరువలేవు ఎలా ఎలా తీరాలి సన్నిధానం ఎలా తీర్చుకోవాలి కనులలో నీరు పునింపినామయ్యా మనసులో ప్రేమను పెంచినామయ్యా కనులలో నీరు కొనింపినామయ్యా మనసులో ప్రేమను పెంచినామయ్యా పలుకులో సత్యంను నడకలో ధర్మం అడుగడుగు నీ బాట నడిచినామయ్యా కరుణామూర్తి మారుదయవర్తి కరుణామూర్తి మారుదయవర్తి ఎన్ని జన్మల ఫలము సన్నిధానం ఎన్ని జన్మల ఫలము సన్నిధానం స్వార్థరహిత సేవ చేసి దీక్షలతోని సందేశము చాటుతా సందేశము చాటుతా సందేశము చాటుతా భక్తి శక్తి యుక్తులతో భరత నీతి నిలబడదా వెంట జంట నుండి మము నడిపించుము స్వామి మము నడిపించుము స్వామి మము నడిపించుము స్వామి సాయిరాం సత్య సాయిరాం సాయిరాం సత్య సాయిరాం సాయిరాం సత్య సాయిరాం సాయిరాం సత్య సాయిరాం సత్య సాయిరాం సత్య సాయిరాం సత్య సాయిరాం.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We are in the middle of a very enlightening satsang. I would say enlightening even for us, because most of the time when we speak here, we know that Swami speaks through us, and as always, we are the first listeners before anybody else. So Arvind, let's get back to that story you were telling about how we don't come to Swami unless we are called, unless He chooses that we come to Him.
Really, because this is one myth we should shatter and think that we came to Swami because my parents are devotees, or he came to Swami because I traveled to Puttaparthi. You know, this incident that was narrated by Shri Arun Mandale, he's still there in Indore, he stays, he is the convener. Okay. I have extensively used, if I can call that, would use that term, use this incident because it is so inspiring, you know. He said that he noticed, this was sometime in the 90s, early 90s, he noticed that the number of people who used to come to his bhajan, to his house bhajan every Thursday, it began to increase exponentially. And he began to wonder, who are these new people, new devotees? I mean, there used to be one or two new devotees every half year or so, but a spurt of new devotees, he was wondering who they are, so he would go to them and ask them, Sairam, are you new? Have you come now? Where are you coming from? And all that. And they would, all of them would give reference to one sadhu. You know, they would say that, oh, you know, in the bus stand we met, suddenly the sadhu came and he was very nice. We spoke to him and finally he said, if you want peace of mind, go to this house for bhajan. Then somebody else said, at the railway station we met, the same sadhu, the same story. Somebody else met him at the market, the same sadhu, the same story. So now, Mr. Mandale became very, very curious and eager to find out who is the sadhu and what is it that he is doing. Since most of the stories had the sadhu telling them at the railway station, he decided to take his chance and go to the railway station to meet the sadhu.
Okay.
He goes to the railway station and he comes across one sadhu and he thinks that probably this is the sadhu that he's seeking. So to confirm, he starts going towards him. When the sadhu calls out and says, "Stop. Don't come near me. If you want to come near me, there are two conditions." What are the two conditions? First thing is, you will not fall at my feet. Second thing is, I will fall at your feet. So, you know, he was really struck by the oddity of these requests that he's making, these two conditions. But he was so curious to know what is it, no more, that he agreed to the conditions actually, you know, to give Padnamskar and not take Padnamskar. That was from a sadhu. And when he went to this sadhu, this holy man, this person, the holy man started narrating his life story. He said that he was a disciple of Swami Shivananda at Rishikesh.
Okay.
You know, Swami Shivananda,
visited his ashram in...
Yes, I think in 1961 it was.
Right,
in 1961.
First trip to Rishikesh.
Yes, he visited the ashram and that time Swami Shivananda was in the wheelchair.
Right.
And Satyam Shyam Sundaram records that Swami materialized a mala also for him. Anyway, that was a trip during which Swami Shivananda, at that time this sadhu, he says he was a disciple there in the ashram. And his father had left him at the ashram when he was 6 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And when Swami visited, he was about 13 years old. So 6-7 years into that life as a sadhaka. And he says that, you know, if you see Swami Shivananda's teachings, it's all about Advaita. It's about one God that is being, and he doesn't advocate any form or name or anything. But he, that great Shivananda, when he fell at Swami's feet, he bent and touched Swami's feet, the disciples, they say that, you know, this sadhu was saying that we were all stunned and shocked. When the guru is talking about the Advaita, who is this person, who is this young, curly-haired, crinky-haired, robed figure, at whose feet our guru is falling? And that was his experience, that was what he saw. And then Swami left, you know, Swami went on and this sadhu concluded that this person who had come must be some other guru in the Himalayas.
Mm-hmm.
And these people in Rishikesh, you know, they have a kind of cycle. Every summer, when the snow melts in the Himalayas and it's relatively warmer, they go off into the inner recesses, into their caves in the Himalayas. And that is where they do their sadhana, their meditation and everything. And once winter sets in and it becomes too chill, that is when they come to their ashram in Rishikesh, which is at the foothills of the Himalayas. So there it's decently warm, it's not very chill. So they tide over the winter in the ashram. So in the summer, you know, they trek long distances in the hills, treacherous paths to reach their sadhana, places of sadhana in the cave.
Okay.
So this sadhu said that when he reached there, he suddenly noticed that he had forgotten matches. Now, matches are such a trivial thing, but it's so important when you want to light a fire for your everything, everyday needs, and you have to traverse now kilometers to get it. And he says, when he was thinking of these matches, suddenly, out of the blue, in walks Swami into his cave, and says that, you know, you want this matches, and he gives it to him, and he goes. So he's so thrilled, and he says, wow, this Baba, or this whoever this is, his cave also must be somewhere nearby, because, you know, he's walking into my cave, giving this and going. And he says on two occasions it happened like this. Once was matches and other time, I'm not remembering, maybe it was milk, I think, where Swami comes and gives him that. And he's so thrilled and he says that, you know, this person is so great because I remember my guru, Swami Shivananda, had, you know, paid his obeisance to him. By this time, Swami Shivananda had left his physical body. So he thought that such a person is coming to meet me in my cave. Let me take that effort to go and meet him in his cave once.
Mm-hmm.
So that is how he set out to find Swami. And what he found was shocking to him. He found that this person does not... He found it out via a photograph in one of the shops there. Even to this day, Prem, just go to Rishikesh, Haridwar, all these places. Many shops have got Swami's photograph.
Okay.
I had seen it when I had gone. So he got to know that this person is from some place in South India. Now for him, South India was like a foreign land because all his life he had stayed in the north, at Rishikesh itself. So, he caught a train to the south, to Chennai, to Madras, that was then Madras. So, because he didn't know where in South India, nothing, he couldn't get those details. So when he went to Madras, again at the Madras railway station, he began to now search for ways and means to get to this Swami.
Mm-hmm.
That was when he discovered his photograph in another shop, and where that person said that, gave him directions to go to Puttaparthi. And the direction those days were, go to Dharmavaram, which is a railway station there, right. It's a junction. At Dharmavaram, get off and take a bus and come to Puttaparthi. And that is where you can meet this Swami. So he decided he will do that, and he landed, and when he arrived at Dharmavaram railway station, it was quite late in the evening, and the last bus to Puttaparthi had already left.
Mm-hmm.
So this sadhu thought that it is best that I will sleep on the platform here, and having slept on the rocky, icy, cold surfaces in the Himalayan mountains, I'm sure that this railway platform was like a comfortable bed for him. He spent his night on the railway station, and then he was telling Mr. Arun Mandale that the next morning when I woke up, I felt a chill and I felt a very hard floor. And it was dark all around. It's early in the morning, but it's completely dark. I woke up, and as I walked out of my cave in the Himalayas. And he's saying, I was totally disoriented. I did not know what is happening. I mean, I was in somewhere in South India. I have traveled in the train. I mean, it's literally like that Janaka's, Idi Nijama, Adi Nijama. Is this real or is that real? Did I dream the whole thing? What was it? And he says, when he went back into the cave, he says that he heard an inner voice which told him that your time has not yet come. When the time comes, I will call you to Puttaparthi. And as of that day, he was telling Mr. Arun Mandale that till this day, I have not been able to step on the soil of Puttaparthi. I have not been able to see in the physical Swami, though I have had his darshan in my cave. I have never been able to see him in the physical. And you have been to Puttaparthi, you have seen him, you have even spoken to him, I know it. Now that is why I say, I will not allow you to fall at my feet, let me fall at your feet. And with great humility, Arun Mandale sir was saying that, you know, we do not realize what it means to have got Swami. We are like, you know, we spoke during the last satsang of the child who plays with a diamond thinking it's a marble, till we are told by a third party of how valuable it is. Like that, we need someone else to actually remind us of the glory and grandeur of the blessing that we have got. This Mahapurusha Samshraya, which is our sure short way to achieve moksha. That is something we should always keep in mind.
Even as you're narrating this, and I was reminded of something which I read in a book, I think by an Italian devotee. Now, she says that, like many others, she was introduced to Swami through a book. I think most probably it must be The Man of Miracles.
Mm-hmm.
So she's so fascinated, she wants to come and see Swami. And she makes all the preparations, she buys the tickets to India. And then she meets somebody who is very clairvoyant, who tells her, who doesn't know about her trip to India, who says that on the 16th of, on the 17th of May, or some date like that, May or June or July, I'm not too sure of the particulars. He says, on the 17th of May, you are going to meet divinity. You're going to meet a very, very divine personage.
Okay. Hmm.
That's what she's told, and she checks the schedule which she has prepared, you know, the itinerary.
The 17th is Puttaparthi,
right?
Right.
According to that, she's supposed to have her first darshan on the 16th.
Oh.
On the 16th of that month in the evening. So she says, okay, this guy has almost got it right. And she was also very happy that there's being a reference to Swami is being made. So she comes to India and she comes, drives down from Bangalore. And on 16th evening, she's sitting for darshan. And you can imagine a Westerner who is not used to all these inconveniences you would find in India. And she is absolutely in discomfort because of the heat and because of the crowd around. There's so many people around. And she's so irritated.
There was no Kulwanthal then.
Right. I think Kulwanthal was not there. I think must be the initial years of the Kulwanthal with just the roof. And she was in such a disturbed state that she couldn't concentrate. So after some time she said, you know, why am I so agitated? I've come here to see Swami. And look at all these people, you know, there is no distinction between them. There is the rich and the poor, and everybody is sitting and all of them are focused to see Swami. And she said, is there a better place than this to sit and meditate, where there are so much of good vibrations around? So when she thinks of this, she just goes into a very, very deep state of meditation. She loses contact with the world outside.
Hmm.
She is in a very, very deep state of meditation. Of course, she's been a person who meditates regularly, but she's never been in this kind of a deep meditative state. After some time, she is disturbed because of people walking all around her. So she gets up and she sees everybody is getting up and walking away. So she asks one of the ladies beside her, why are you all walking away? Isn't Swami coming for darshan? And that lady is surprised. He says, what do you mean, didn't Swami come for darshan? Didn't you see Swami? Swami came this way and Swami went and sat on the dais. He sat for darshan and took aarti and went. And that's when she realized she was in such a deep state of meditation, she didn't even realize that Swami came for darshan, gave darshan and went back. As professed, she had darshan only on the next day, which was the 17th of May. And she writes that, you know, it is absolutely beyond your control when you even see Swami. You can be in Puttaparthi, you can be right in front of Swami, but if you are not meant to see Swami, you will not see Swami. And I think that's what, finally, when you talk of these three boons, as you said, Manushyatvam, yes, of course, we all have it. That's why we are sitting and listening to these, to our satsang and why we are speaking. That is because of we've been given a human birth. Mahapurusha Samshraya, to even know of Swami, to have the knowledge of Swami's advent, itself is such a grand boon. So now I think our duty is to not waste these two boons. And that is if we foster mumukshatvam, the desire to go higher.
Exactly. Because that is when, you know, the three pieces of the puzzle come together and we start moving towards fulfillment in life, joy in life, peace in life. Because two of them without the other is of no use. And the good fortune that we have all received, a higher blessing, is that those who are considered blessed are given the first two, and third is something that they should hope that happens to them. The advantage and the greatest blessing is we have been given the one and three. We have been given a human birth and we have been made aware of the living divinity, of Swami's presence in our lives. We just have to take and make those few little efforts to try to find out the reality of life. And then everything will unfold on its own. It's an automated process which is guided beautifully by Swami, because we have got Mahapurusha Samshraya before Mumukshatvam. So, being grateful to Swami for this wonderful blessing, always keeping Him in our mind and heart, always keeping His name on our lips, His sweet love in our hearts, singing His name and singing His glory and living in Him, let us fructify our lives, let us sanctify our lives. Dear listeners, the time is almost complete for this week's satsang. And as always, we offer this at the lotus feet of our dear Swami, who is ever present with us in the studios, in our homes, in our offices, wherever we are, because He is, as Swami says, this Sai is your Hridayasthai. He is the indweller of your heart. Offering gratitude to that Hridayasthai Sai, both Prem and me, take your leave. We leave you with this song, the other side of which, as always, you will be joined by Brother Chandu with his ebullient and exuberant segment, Love to Love.
मन मेरो लागे ना तेरे बिना साई मन मेरो लागे ना तेरे बिना मन मेरो लागे ना तेरे बिना रे
मन मेरो लागे ना तेरे बिना रे
तेरे दर्शन के प्यासे अखियां
तेरे दर्शन की प्यासी
जीवन ज्योत जलाओ साई मेरे मेरो लागे ना तेरे बिना रे,
मन मेरो लागे ना तेरे बिना रे।
छवि अति सुंदर केश ये है घुंघराले निराले,
तेरी छवि अति सुंदर केश ये है घुंघराले निराले,
नयन कमल मन मोहक मादक रंजित है अधरारे,
तेरी छवि अति सुंदर केश ये है घुंघराले निराले,
इस छवि को हम मन में भर कर तेरे गुण को गाए,
तेरे गुण को गाए,
मन मेरो लागे ना तेरे बिना रे,
मन मेरो लागे ना तेरे बिना रे।
तेरे बिना जग माया काए बंधन टूट न पाए,
तेरे बिना जग माया काए
बंधन टूट न पाए,
जीवन मैया पग पग डोले, जीवन मैया पग पग डोले,
तू ही पार लगाए
तेरी शरण में लेके प्रभु तू कृपा शांति बरसाए,
कृपा शांति बरसाए,
मन मेरो लागे ना तेरे बिना रे,
मन मेरो लागे ना तेरे बिना रे,
तेरे दर्शन की प्यासी अखियां,
तेरे दर्शन की प्यासी, जीवन ज्योत जला साई मेरे,
जीवन ज्योत जलाओ साई मेरे,
मन मेरो लागे ना तेरे बिना।